Well, I hope you're all settling in to be here at Loon Lake. You know, it takes a day or two, but thank you. I hope you're all settling in to being here at Loon Lake with your whole being. With your body and your senses and your mind, the whole package. What I love most about our practice is the whole package. I remember going to Tassajara, you know, Tassajara, the holy of holies, and I realized they were just getting the serving instructions written down. After how many years? Or maybe they were rewriting. And I thought, oh, you know, it's so beautiful here, and they've got, you know, gorgeous big instruments, bells and things. But there, it's still only a few decades new here, too. But, and I thought, oh, look, it's the whole package. And we have that whole package, too. We have all the ingredients. And it was the whole, all those little pieces put together of the practice, being able to sink deeply in over even more time. Not coming, rushing from your crazy busy life to get to Sesshin, but sinking in day after day after day, and then having Sesshin. It was so, so valuable. So I hope you get a taste of that, you know, in these few days at Loon Lake. And the feeling of, you know, this practice being passed down to us over so many, you know, like hundreds and hundreds of years from those ancestors who, you know, bravely practiced in conditions much more adverse than ours. Anyway, thank you, Norman, for telling Mitsu Suzuki's story yesterday. That was a beautiful surprise. I only had the privilege of meeting her twice. And the first time I was so moved, I just thought, there needs to be another translation of her haiku. And the second time, I got to show her the manuscript and hear her reminiscences as she read the haiku. And it was pretty great. I really feel she is one of my poet Dharma women ancestors, even though I only met her twice. She's kind of an imaginary grandmother to me. And I really feel sometimes a sense of guidance from her. So thanks for bringing her into the circle of ancestors here. As you know by now, we've been spending time with the Zen's Chinese ancestors, and our hope was that people would get better acquainted with them and realize that their lives and their teachings are not so distant from our own as they might appear at first glance, and, you know, some of the difficult literature, perhaps. And we really hope that some of those old stories and dialogues would resonate still and would encourage us, maybe give us a gentle nudge, or sometimes we need a firm shove out of one of our more habitual ruts. As we approach this practice period, there was a time, it continues to be a time, of urgent discussion and action around the climate crisis. And I wondered if we should make that our theme. Although, I think it was 3 years ago, Vicky was our shuso, and our theme was engage practice, and we certainly I think that has inspired us since to make space for that those discussions in the Zendo and in our practice. But what is conventionally called climate change is so much more than a crisis of extreme weather. It's about the threatened well-being of myriad species all over the world and the ecosystems in which they live, upon which our well-being and ultimate survival depend. And it's about human injustice and inequality and the disproportionate severity of climate change effects on those with less wealth and political power. And it's about the belief that those with wealth and political power are somehow going to manage to be immune, to be able to barricade themselves and maintain the standard of living to which they and we are accustomed. You know, we're accustomed to a pretty comfortable standard of living, most of us here. We probably wouldn't be here at the Zendo right now. So I set a personal intention at the outset of practice period to just notice how the teachings of the Chinese Zen ancestors spoke to our present day challenges, and particularly around the climate crisis. So I thought I would share with you some of what has moved me, both from the Chinese ancestors and from my extracurricular reading. One thing that impressed me about our Chinese ancestors is what difficult times they lived through. You know, incredible political and social instability and famine and plagues and starvation. You know, really a great deal of hardship and death and illness. And how resourceful and innovative they needed to be to survive and keep the Dharma alive, keep the practice going. What a radical measure Baijiang took to have monks do physical labor, to grow and cook food and maintain the monastery. That hadn't been done before. And he created a set of monastic practices that we use to this day, this simple way of living that extends our Zazen practice into every aspect of our waking and sleeping hours, and sleeping. We don't even have a monastery. Look, we're sitting in a basketball court. And we have a storefront Zendo on Wall Street in Vancouver. That's our adaptation to our troubled times, to make it possible to practice. You know, and we fumble around and do the practice. And how many of us have yearned for a simpler, quieter way of life? To step away, you know, from our frantic urban busyness and grow our own food, take responsibility for nourishing the land and the beings that support our lives. I know it's been an ongoing theme for me. I did that when I was really young. There's an old Zen story from China that comes to mind. I'm sure many of you have heard it. Dizang was working in the field. I think he was a Zen master by then, probably. He was working in the field, and a monk came along. Dizang asked him, "Where do you come from?" The monk said, "From the south." Dizang asked him, "How is Buddha Dharma in the south?" "It's being discussed all over," said the monk. "How can that compare with me here planting the fields, growing food to eat?" said Dizang. The monk said, "What about the world?" And Dizang said, "What do you call the world?" You know, so first Dizong asks the monk where he's from, and the monk makes the mistake of taking him literally and says, from the south. He took the bait and assumed a division between north and south, you know, like all the dichotomies we habitually create. Soto and Rinzai Zen, liberal and conservative, Republican and Democrat, blue and red, orange and other colors. Black and white, rich and poor. Even to talk about taking our practice into the world, you know how we sometimes say that? Oh, we're going to take our practice into the world. It implies that there's an inside and outside. That there's here and there. But Dizong strings the monk along. He says, so how is Buddha Dharma in the South? Widely discussed. That sounds like good news. But Dizong isn't going to let him get away with it. He says, how can all that discussion compare with me here planting the fields, growing food to eat? Kind of reminds us of the poem by Layman Pang that Michael read about the superpowers of chopping wood and carrying water, planting the field. But what about the world? Isn't there more to say than just plant the fields, just make rice balls to eat? How can we say of the world? We can relate to that, can't we? We just do our mundane jobs, you know, get up, go to work. How can we save the world? But Dizong lobs the question right back at him. He says, what do you call the world? Out there, elsewhere, you think it's you saving the world? You've got it upside down. As we've learned about the lives of these old Chinese Zen ancestors, we've often seen how they went on pilgrimage, wandering through villages and mountains, visiting monasteries and hermitages and practicing with different teachers. And they'd enter into these lively dialogues, right? And actions, sometimes they're enacting, you know, acting things out. And these became passed down orally and then written, and we know them as koans, right? They became teaching stories. But these old pilgrims carried their deepest questions with them, just like we do today. Dongshan, who's known as the founder of the Caodong or Soto Zen school in China, once visited Zen master Nanyuan. And when he took his leave, Nanyuan told him, make a thorough study of Buddha Dharma and broadly benefit the world. Dongshan said, I have no question about studying the Buddha Dharma, but what is it to broadly benefit the world? How do I do that? And Nanyuan replied, not to disregard a single thing, a single being, not to disregard a single being. Well, that's a tall order. Obviously impossible. Every day we disregard beings, don't we? Just walk down the street, we disregard beings. Great and small, in our own preoccupation with what we need to do next, you know, with our worries. So this is getting into the territory of the bodhisattva's impossible vow to save all beings, right? Often people approaching the thought of Jukai formally receiving the precepts say, you know, how can I vow something I will so miserably fail at, right? Isn't it hubris to make a vow like that? But maybe the self-clinging, whether it's hubris or whether it's the flip side of hubris, which is unworthiness, chronic unworthiness and inadequacy, maybe either way, the self-clinging is to think that I'm the one doing the saving. Right? Another pair of ancestors, the Dharma brothers, Yunyan and Dawu, I just kind of flashed on an image of the Dharma Brothers little cartoon strips. Could somebody who's good make one of those? Good cartoonist? Yeah. So Yunyan and Dawu struggled with this same problem. How do we do it, you know? And here's their dialogue, and this is one that Vicky shared with us and talked about a few Wednesday nights ago in the Zendo. And I'm sure many of you know it. Yunyan asked Dawu, "What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes for?" We don't have an image amongst our collection of the thousand-armed Kanon or Kuan Yin, but I think you've all probably seen one somewhere, right? And each hand of each of those arms has an eye in the palm, if you look closely, to see the suffering of a particular being, you know. And each one has a tool, all different kinds of tools, to respond appropriately to the suffering of particular beings in this relative world. So Dao answered, "It's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night." In other words, it's a natural, embodied response. The right hand doesn't argue with the left, like, "I did it last time, why don't you take a turn?" Right? And the head doesn't complain to the hand, "Can't you arrange that pillow the way I told you to?" You know, no, we don't. We just do it. Well, maybe we do sometimes treat our body parts like another, especially when they're not performing the way they once did or the way we'd like them to. I think there's sort of I confess, I've done it myself. And there's a kind of a sad cruelty when we treat our own bodies that way. Zen Master Lungya said, "In this life, save the body. It is the fruit of many lives." And our bodies are the fruit of many lives. Just think, you know, of all the beings we have eaten, whose bodies we have metabolized to fuel our activity, all our evolutionary ancestors, from single cells squiggling through the primordial soup, to the early hominids learning how to speak and wield tools and weapons. That all that's in our bodies. But back to our Dharma brothers. So Dawu said, "It's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night." "I understand," said Yunyan. "How do you understand?" Dawu asked him. "All over the bodies are hands and eyes. Sorry, all over the body are hands and eyes." And Dawu said, "You've said quite a bit there, but you've only said about 80%. Can't win." So Yunyan said, "What do you say, elder brother?" And Dawu said, "Throughout the body are hands and eyes." So we don't need to spend time quibbling over which one is right. Some of the commentaries say they both are. But I love the image of our whole bodies as sense organs, and the sense organs as Dharma gates, opening to compassion and responding with skillful means. And this turns out to be quite congruent with the latest understandings from neuroscience, which is more than I can include in this talk. So sorry, but you can find this. And it's so marvelous that it's so congruent with this old, old image. Anyway, how does all this apply when it comes to extremely complex environmental issues that we now face in the 21st century? We try to recycle conscientiously until we realize that our recycling is being shipped to China or the Philippines for children to sort and process. And as you know, some of our huge amount of electronic waste is very, very toxic. So we try to stop using plastic until we realize that the more we pay attention, the more we realize how pervasive plastic is in every aspect of our lives, everything from our cars to our toothbrushes. And we can easily feel overwhelmed at the immensity and complexity of it all. And we can feel like, what difference can I make? You know, one little person shaving down a stick to brush my teeth. What difference is it going to make? Because I haven't really. But I really don't like those toothbrushes. That, why does everything have to look like a running shoe, even a toothbrush? You know, we can really easily feel discouraged. But we have to realize that we are not disconnected individuals. Each of us is one arm of Kanlon Bodhisattva with a particular tool or a particular toolkit, because we usually mostly have more than one. But we're not good at using them all, you know. We don't have to compete with the other arms. That person who can do that other thing that I so much better than me. We don't have to do that. It does help to cooperate. But all those arms together do make a difference. Enough votes, enough petition signed, enough boycotts make a difference. As well as countless ordinary, simple acts of kindness, the results of which we may never see or know. Enough people making art and planting trees or writing poetry or making good soup. And enough people learning to sit still together and pay attention to their lives. All this makes a difference, just not as fast as we want it to, and as obviously as we want it to. When the need for change seems so urgent, it might seem avoidant to talk about deep time, but I want to. Our Buddhist ancestors knew a thing or two about deep time. You know, we hear about kalpas, right? These incredibly, unimaginably long lengths of time. And they didn't know anything about evolution or mass extinctions in the past. But they knew there were cycles of creation, continuation, and destruction. Somehow they knew that. This past August, Michael and I went hiking. We do what we call hiking sesshins. They seem to be getting shorter in the mountains in the summer. But we still got up there and hiked in the mountains. And then we went, that was in Banff. And then we went to see Michael's brother northeast of Calgary. And we spent a day at the Royal Tyrrell Museum outside of Drumheller, Alberta. And this is a world-renowned museum of paleontology. I had never been. I thought it was, you know, some more old dusty dinosaur bones like we've all seen before. This place is really quite beautifully done. It's a kind of journey back into deep time. And through the five great extinction events in Earth's history. Late Devonian, 375 million years ago, 75% of species lost. End Permian, 251 million years ago, 96% of species lost. End Triassic, 200 million years ago, 80% of species lost. End Cretaceous, 66 million years ago, 76% of species lost. These events were caused by global climate change, likely including at least one massive collision between Earth and an asteroid, a giant asteroid. The Earth and Earth systems have experienced severe climate change many times with drastic consequences, and each time there's been this incredible resurgence of beautiful, complex, diverse life forms over millions of years. And I don't mean this, and I didn't take it as cold comfort in the face of what's being called the sixth extinction caused by human transformation of the environment. But I still felt a sense of deep awe. There have been times I've felt, I don't know if I want to live on an earth without elephants, without tigers, without gorillas. And not just those so-called, they're called charismatic megafauna, which I think is really silly. But anyway, silly thing to call them. But the tree swallows, the Pacific tree frogs, the monarch butterflies, and the stunningly beautiful microflora and fauna that we call plankton, without which we will not live. In one room of this museum, which I'm going to say was almost, close to the width of this room, was the fossilized remains of a huge creature laid out on the floor. It was the best preserved armored dinosaur in the world, one of the best. The oldest known dinosaur ever found in Alberta, over 100 million years old. It was discovered only in 2011 by a worker in the Suncor Energy Millennium Mine in the tar sands north of Fort McMurray. It turned out to be a new genus and a new species, and they called it Borealopelta. I don't know what pelta means, I didn't look it up, but boreal north, right? Boreopelta Mark Mitchelly. Can you imagine being some guy working in the oil patch, discovering this and having it named after you? Amazing. You could see its skin, you could see its armored plates. Even where there was a break in the rib cage, you could see some kind of fossilized internal organs. And somehow, unlike those dusty dinosaur bones, you know, that we've all seen, I could feel this thing, this huge creature as a living being, you know, going through the swamp. And I just felt, it brought tears to my eyes. It was so moving. And I remembered a dream that I had many, many years ago of being in an underground chamber with this creature, the remains of a creature that had been there a really long time, dead, but it was still, there was like still sentience. And I was in some kind of communication with this ancient creature. And it reminded me of that. So after this experience, while I was reading about our Chan ancestors, I got the book, The Sixth Extinction, by Elizabeth Colbert, because I wanted to see and understand and feel it. And she tells the stories of the great extinctions of the past and how we learned about them. I mean, we only knew about all this very recently in human history. You know, we didn't know. And she also tells of the quietly heroic bodhisattvas who are devoting their lives to studying and doing all they can to stem the tide of extinction currently underway. They're studying bats and frogs and rhinos and plankton. They're protecting habitat. They're campaigning against pesticides. They're running captive breeding programs. So many arms, right? Doing so many things. So I read another, I call these Dharma books, even though their authors would probably be quite surprised. Another one I read, it's called The Mushroom at the End of the World, on the possibility of life in capitalist ruins, by an anthropologist named Anna Lowenhaupt Singh. There's the mushroom. Anybody recognize that mushroom? That is a matsutake, or pine mushroom. She focuses her story on the matsutake, and it's a complex story that's emblematic in curious ways of our precarious times. The pine mushroom is an extremely expensive luxury item in Japan, once only available to the nobility, but the deforestation of Japan's ancient cedar and cypress forests led to the growth of pines, because pines thrive in disrupted degraded soil, and an efflorescence of pine mushroom at around the same time that the merchant class was rising and more people had money, and so acquiring pine mushrooms became a status thing for more people. And so in modern times, with even more population growth, even more, Japan probably has had, over several decades, the highest proportion of middle class anywhere. You know, very little poverty, very little extreme wealth, even compared to North America, by far compared to North America. So everybody wanted matsutake. So the market extended offshore across the Pacific to the massive degraded pine forests, or massive degraded forests of Oregon, where the Douglas fir and the red cedar and the big pines, ponderosas, had been stripped. And then, so the lodgepole, the scrappier pines, grew up, and matsutake. And who moved in to harvest the bounty? Refugees from Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, former hill tribe people who were struggling in the cities when their aid ran out, was cut short, and for whom camping out and gathering mushrooms in the mountains evoked their earlier way of life. They were good at it. Also, Vietnam vets who had cut themselves off from mainstream society, and eccentric survivalists living on the margins, right? Eking out a seasonal living, picking mushrooms. This precarious wild crop sold to middlemen and then on to larger dealers, many of them in Vancouver, to ship to Japan. And not only the forests of Oregon supplied the matsutake trade, still do, the forests of Yunnan province in the southwest of China, and of all places, Finland, are the main suppliers. And each of these cultures has different social, economic relationships to the harvesting and to the maintenance of the forests. So they're being deliberately maintained for matsutake, but differently in each of these countries, right? And then there are the second, third, and fourth generations of Japanese Americans who make going to the mountains to pick matsutake a picnic outing, a way of reenacting cultural tradition and reconnecting to their ancestors. So in the book, she includes a couple of matsutake haiku, which I think have some Zen resonance. The moving cloud fades away, and I smell the aroma of the matsutake. Ah, matsutake, the excitement before finding them. The author, Tsing, says, "This is a story we know. It is the story of pioneers, progress, and the transformation of empty, in quotes, empty spaces into industrial resource fields. So she's talking about this is our story, this is our familiar story of the forests, of the oil fields, of the oceans. And then she said, this is a story we need to know. Industrial transformation turned out to be a bubble of promise, followed by lost livelihoods and damaged landscapes. And yet, such documents are not enough. If we end the story with decay, we abandon all hope, or turn our attention to other sites of promise and ruin. Promise and ruin. She's describing, I think, what will be more and more the case in the future we are facing. Great change and adaptation, complex interlocking systems of, on a global scale, and right in the middle of destruction, there will be pockets of regeneration, resourcefulness, community. And one thing she makes a strong point about is that collaboration across lines of diversity will be really important. It won't be all neat and tidy. It won't be clearly good or bad, harmful or beneficial. It'll be mixed. It'll be contaminated, just like our daily lives are, right? Try to observe the precepts perfectly, and you'll see what I mean. So we need to have great capacity to live, to be able to shift when we know we're being rigid, when our views are contracted, to open up, to be okay with not knowing for sure how it will turn out, and to be willing to extend a bodhisattva hand, and not just to those we're most familiar with. Again, Singh says precarity, she uses this word precarity, which is precariousness, is the condition of being vulnerable to others. Unpredictable encounters transform us. Have you had any unpredictable encounters this week? Have they transformed you? We are not in control, even of ourselves. Unable to rely on a stable structure of community, and by this I think she means the conventional structures that we take for granted, you know. We think our government should work well, you know, the bureaucracy should work. We get really frustrated when it doesn't. Unable to rely on those structures, we are thrown into shifting assemblages which remake us as well as our others. In a way, I think even stepping into Sesshin is stepping into that precariousness, you know. I'm not talking about all this to be discouraging. Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. I read yet another Dharma book, this one by a philosopher of ethics. His name's Kwame Anthony Appiah, writes a column in the New York Times magazine. The book's called The Honor Code, How Moral Revolutions Happen. And it would take another whole talk to tell you about this book. But briefly, he investigates how we humans have made significant changes in our moral behavior. And his examples are how dueling ended in England as a way of, you know, solving insults and conflict. How foot binding ended in China. How the end of the Atlantic slave trade, and hopefully the beginning of the end of honor killings in Pakistan. Those are his examples. And in each case, the changes took place surprisingly quickly, like within one or two generations, once certain shifts occurred in attitudes and circumstances, right? And each of those shifts involved an expansion of the ethic of non-harming beyond previous limits, beyond the limits set by class, race, gender, etc. An expansion of the sphere of care. Each of those shifts, and they happened quite quickly. So it may be that we're on the cusp of another moral revolution. If the turnout for the youth climate marches is any indication. And this moral revolution involves extending our ethic of care to fellow humans who are different from us and to the creatures with whom we co-inhabit this earth and to the ecosystems which support us all, not disregarding a single being. It seems to me the Bodhisattva path is a pretty good basis for such a moral revolution, cultivating the paramitas that Norman's book is about, that he's been telling us about, generosity, morality, patience, joyous effort, meditation, wisdom. Hongjir, Michael mentioned Hongjir, lived in the 12th, one of our 12th century ancestors, said this: fully appreciate the emptiness of all dharmas. Then all minds are free and all dusts evaporate in the original brilliance shining everywhere. Transforming according to circumstances, meet all beings as your ancestors. Subtly illuminate all conditions, magnanimous beyond all duality. Meet all beings as your ancestors. Our DNA contains millions, to tweak Walt Whitman's words. Every molecule in our body has passed through countless living beings, right? So you might want to practice seeing each being you meet as your ancestor. And then by extension, each being is your child. Your brother, your sister. You know, whether or not you are or will be a biological parent. What if each being is your child? And then, what if we are the ancestors? Whoa, what a responsibility. But our impossible vows are what support us to be worthy ancestors to the generations to come. And as Michael and Norman have both said, we are not in this alone. It is delusion to think so. Even though the old song goes, I don't know, you got to walk that lonesome valley, right? You got to walk it by yourself. Ain't nobody else can walk it for you. You got to walk it by yourself. Well, true, you do. No one else can live your life for you. No one else can die your death for you. No one else can do this practice for you. But if you open your eyes and ears and feel the ground under your feet as you walk that valley, you may see the mountains and the clouds and hear the bird songs and the wind. And you might cross a stream as old Dongshan, our ancestor Dongshan, did, and look down and see your reflection. And say, now I go on alone, everywhere I meet it. Now it is me, now I am not it. That's what Dongshan said. Or maybe you will see, as Hongjir did, that clear and desireless, the wind in the pines and the moon in the water are content in their elements. Without minds interacting, they do not impede one another. Essentially, right, we impede one another because, mostly because we open our mouths, but essentially, you exist in emptiness and have the capacity to respond outwardly without being annoyed. like spring blossoming, like a mirror reflecting forms. Amid all the noise, spontaneously emerge transcendent. If you can sit here with stability, then you can freely step across and engage the world with energy. When you have thoroughly investigated your roots back to their ultimate source, 1,000 or 10,000 sages are no more than footprints on the trail. In wonder, you return to the journey, avail yourself of the path and walk ahead with the 100 grass tips in the busy marketplace. Graciously share yourself. That was Hongzhir. I recently read that the American poet Ada Limon received the National Book Critics Circle Award earlier this year. And in her acceptance speech, she said, "We write with all the good ghosts in our corners. I, for one, have never made anything alone, never written a single poem alone." And then she listed and thanked all those who had supported her. So we don't have to be perfectly realized Buddhas to reach out a hand and offer something of ourselves to the world. The Bodhisattva path is always a work in progress for us human beings. It takes us right into the midst of our own suffering, and that is how we recognize it in others. So we can respond with wisdom and compassion and hopefully the right tool for the job. Nothing like using the wrong tool. It doesn't work. So let us go forward courageously with the good ghosts of our countless ancestors and the good company of our Sangha brothers and sisters, and graciously share the fruit of our practice, the fruit of many lives. So thank you, good companions. Thanks for listening. May our